briefly about the countries and compare that to when I was a kid. Then we go from there with the conclusion later.
All right, folks. Thursday night, we are back at it. This is going to be our last program for the week, and I like to finish these out with Dr. David Wallaloo. He has been on our program many times. I feel like I don't need he doesn't need any introduction on this program, but I have to let everyone know just a little bit about his background. Army, served in the Army. He's been an intelligence officer. He's got a lot of a background in Homeland Security. He's a professor. He's, you name it, he's involved politically. He writes. I don't know. You're writing a book, too, now, from what I understand. Dr. Wallaloo, welcome to the program again. Tonight, we're talking all about NATO.
Thank you very much, Duke. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let me ask you. I'm gonna get right into this. I read your article in Huffington Post, titled "NATO's Invitation of Montenegro Betrays Folly and Lack of Strategic Vision," and as you start reading the article, you do a really good job of mapping out. What seems to me, if I could just put it in a real quick synopsis, that the United States, because of our NATO affiliation, is potentially being dragged into situations that maybe we don't want to be in. Is that right? Is that kind of the gist of it?
That is correct, Dick. You're absolutely correct in your assessment. And the reason being is, obviously, with the fall of the communism, so many questions have emerged as to what the next role for NATO is going to be now that we have defeated the communists. Okay, no more Soviet Union. So what are you going to do with all those members? and this question starts to come up to the surface as to, okay, well, what is the mission going to be of NATO? What's going to become of NATO? There is no more Warsaw Pact that we used to worry about. So you get this alliance, which is a military by nature. And before we get into details, we need to define four main concepts for NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. But one of them is the political and military alliance in itself, which is the purpose of why NATO exists, was to safeguard the freedom and security of its members through different means besides military. They could settle issues through political or diplomacy, but sometimes military is a necessity. And that is what the role for the part of NATO is. On the political aspect, is to promote democratic values that the West and NATO members sort of encourage, but sometimes the political approach might not work to solve certain issues. So NATO will be forced to commit to a peaceful resolutions through if diplomacy doesn't work, then the military operations will be a necessity to settle whatever issues they need to deal with. Then comes after that the collective defense, which basically what NATO is it committed to the principle that I'm sure your listeners have heard about, the fifth article, that any attack on any member of NATO will be considered as an attack on the whole organization. And that's usually this response was about 9/11 when the United States was attacked, and it was considered as an attack on the whole alliance. Then there is the concept of the transatlantic link. What is our role, especially from North America? We're talking about the United States and Canada, but mainly the U.S. Well, we provide a unique link between the two continents as far as consultations, as far as cooperation, and as far as even military exercises and so forth. And this is why you will always notice or you will always see that the commander of NATO, the military commander, is always an American. And the secretary general for NATO is always a European. That has always been the tradition. Now, given all this, questions have emerged, especially after 9/11. 9/11 sort of pushed a new era for NATO to start to get into something they were not comfortable with, they were not accustomed to, especially when you consider countries that have joined in or been invited. I remember when I was a kid, about 13, 14 years old, I used to write down the members. Back then, I remember there were 13 of them. Now you have about 28, and including Albania, Belgium, Bulgaria, Canada, Croatia, Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, France, Germany, Greece, Hungary, Iceland, Italy, Latvia, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Spain, Turkey, the United Kingdom, and the United States. And as you suggested or you mentioned about my article, I did talk about the invitation that NATO extended to Montenegro. Now, why is that problematic at this time, given the turmoil that's taking place in the Middle East, given Russia's aggression against Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea, but also now with the presence of Russia in Syria? What's troubling about all this, Duke, is that Russia has brought some heavy weapons into Syria, weapons that goes beyond belief as far as dealing with ISIS. I mean, we're talking about there are two types of missile systems, the S-300 and the advanced S-400. Those are far advanced missile systems that ISIS doesn't have fighter jets for Russia to bring in their own air defense systems. Those are, and in my suggestion or in my opinion, the interest of Russia goes far beyond the borders of Syria. This is basically has to do with NATO. It's almost like Russia's telling NATO, if you conduct any military training exercises near our border, we will retaliate. And as a matter of fact, Russian President Vladimir Putin did issue the statement, which was, as I mentioned in my article, of a military nature. If you pay attention to the wording, it is of a military nation. Now, one thing I've learned about the Russians is sometimes they don't bluff. They do not bluff. And we have to be careful not to corner the Russians. Why? Because it's unpredictable. We do not know how Putin will react. And Putin, when he gets cornered, he will react aggressively. Not that we're afraid of him or scared of him. It's just we have to make sure we maintain some sort of an order. Can you just imagine a chaos in the Middle East, a military war between Russia and the United States? What it will mean?
Well, you know, it seems to me like NATO is kind of like Big Brother. NATO is a collection of small, not all small, but countries that on their own certainly could not defend themselves against China or Russia, or some other major aggressor. So they have to have strength in numbers. And the concept of the strength in numbers, the unification, the global model, to people like me, that starts to smell like New World Order. It starts to seem like Americans have fewer and fewer rights. I mean, is it, number one, is it possible to pull out of NATO? And number two, what are our immediate problems going to be if we do pull out?
Well, first of all, we can't pull out of NATO. Here is why. Just consider this. The budget of NATO, back in 2013, it was about 67% comes from the United States. We carry NATO on our shoulders. If there is any deployment of NATO forces, the U.S. will have to bear the cost. And that has come to the forefront now some analysts are questioning sort of the wisdom as to why, or as to why Europe is not stepping forward. It's almost like we're going to start seeing Europe like Japan. He wields an economic power, but he has no military. And why should we carry the burdens of the budget for NATO, which is not a small amount? You're looking at over $600 billion. But the United States has to pay about 70% of it.
And that's a general peacetime NATO budget.
That's correct.
I imagine
that
what
is
that
correct.
Turns into. Yeah.
Yeah, can you imagine if a war breaks out between, let's say, Russia and NATO or China and NATO, what the cost is going to become? And we cannot afford that. Why? Because we have our own issues here. I recall we talked about immigration, for example. I recall we talked in your show about education, about the justice system here. I mean, we have our own issues to deal with here. We cannot be spending more than, as a matter of fact, we don't even have that money. We have to borrow that money. And we can't be like that. You got to have to force the Europeans to step forward. You got to force the Europeans to deploy their own resources. Yes, we lead the world. We are the world leaders and so forth. But there is a time where you're going to say enough is enough. And all this, the best example, Dick, will be is what happened after the new approach, like after 2010. The best example was about what took place in Afghanistan or Bosnia or Kosovo. Who was on the front line? They were us.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, at the same time, questions analysts have asked specific questions as to, for example, with the conflict, the nature of the conflict, is the military power enough to secure a tangible victory or not?
You know, I don't think so.
You're absolutely right.
You have a presidential candidates who talk about carpet bombing and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, to me, it's just like you want to beat the chest and make yourself feel good and maybe be liked by a certain group of people. But, I mean, look, when I was in the Air Force, I worked on nuclear missiles. I know what our nuclear capability is, and we don't want to wipe out entire cities of people, civilians. I just don't think we're at that point yet. I think we're a long way from that. But to hear our Republican leaders in our campaign this year talk about carpet bombing and then smiling about it, to me, that just shows that they really don't understand war and the consequences of war.
Specifically, it was Mr. Trump who mentioned that one, which gives you an idea about lack of understanding not only about national security matters, but also about foreign policy. This is now how you conduct yourself around the world. You can't just go and start bombing, and that's not how you conduct foreign policy, because it's not limited only to military action.
It's like if you go to a restaurant and you're rude to the waitress, you can expect that your food's going to be tampered with.
Exactly.
You know, what I want to do right now is I want to bring on a guest caller. Just briefly, I want to let the audience know who this is. He's a friend that I met. He was campaigning for the state house. He's from South Texas region. Now he's in Dallas, but he's prior military, served the country honorably, became a teacher. So you guys have an education background together. But now he works in immigration. He's an immigration agent. And so maybe he's got something he can add to this conversation. Joel De Los Santos, what's going on?
Hey, Duke, how's it going? Doing pretty good.
Yeah, we're just here trying to solve some of the world's problems with Dr. David Wallaloo.
And Doctor, I agree with you about the NATO. I was in Madrid in with NATO. I was there for about a month. I was doing a lot of digitizing records. And during that time, dealing with the Spaniards and dealing with different countries there, we had almost every country you could think of that was part of the NATO. And it worked out pretty good. I mean, we had this was in 2009 when I was out there. And but, you know, does it work? And basically going back, like what you said, you know, basically like a brotherhood. Okay. So if somebody picks on one brother, then all brothers have to join the fight. And that deals with the article, I believe Article 5 or Article 51 of the NATO, I guess policies. And it's been going on for years, and to this day, I mean, ever since, you know, the first couple of countries, you know, that was developed back in 1949, and eventually, uh-huh. like in the 50s, you had like Greece, Turkey, and Germany jumped in, and then later on, Spain in the 80s, and then like you said, like the Czech Republic came in into 1999, and also in Hungary and Poland and Bulgaria, and then eventually Croatia came in. You know, towards the end. And so it's one of those things that people that don't know about NATO, you know, it's a big impact. Are we involved? Yes, we're definitely involved. And like Duke said, you know, him, you know, in the military during the Cold War, because I was exposed to the Cold War, and that was the thing, because, you know, if the eagle, you know, and the bear would actually get into an actual fist fight, I mean, the world will end. I mean, regardless. Yeah, yeah. I mean, at that time, it was, you know, everybody lived in fear, especially who was going to be the person, you know, to push that button, either through sea, through air, or wherever. I mean, because now, and one of the things that kind of like scared me now, especially, you know, of course, you know, Russia is basically, you know, I guess it leaked out through the internet and they stopped it. The new submarine that was coming out, and that kind of like at first when I heard it, I thought, well, it's got to be a joke, but then after I did a little research, I said, yeah. Oh my God, you know, this is no joke, you know, Putin is basically trying to, you know, control the sea again, and especially having that type of a sophisticated type of submarine in the water. That is a big, you know, to me, that scares me, especially, so, you know, being undetected.
So this goes back to what David Wallaloo was saying, we're going to call him the good doctor now. So what he was saying ultimately is that, you know, to me, it's about geography, it's territory. Why does Russia want that territory? Because it's accessible. You know, if they have to load a freight or they have to have ships come to port, they need the territory. So, you know, if they've got to just step in and take it, if there was no NATO forces, they'd probably, well, heck, they're doing it regardless. They're making moves regardless of the NATO in full violation of what NATO ordinances are. And who cares? Who's doing anything about it? We're not.
No, we're not. Well, the interesting thing about what you guys mentioned, that when you served during 2009, that was probably during the time when Yap de Hoop Schaefer was the Secretary General at the time before Rasmussen took over, because Rasmussen took over in, I believe, sometime in August 2009 till 2014. When the new secretary, Jens Stoltenberg, took over from there. Here's the issue that I see. And what your guest mentioned was absolutely correct. And yet the question that we always need to ask is, what is now, given the changes in on the geopolitical landscape, what is the mission now of NATO? And obviously, during the Cold War years, the enemy was defined. We knew who the enemy was. Now, that definition of security has radically expanded to include the rogue state, terrorists, jihadists. We have no idea who's who. Extremism, whatever you want to call it. And that's now NATO finding itself, okay, how are they going to change their strategies? How are they going to change the mission? How are they going to adopt a new culture with so many members that I would say half of them, they are contributing somehow to overall mission of NATO, but not to the level where it needs to be. And this is why you have your main players, especially the United States. Here is the weight of NATO. And this is why what you mentioned earlier about us leaving NATO, I just don't see that happening, because if we leave, it will crumble. It will crumble. U.S. leadership is a necessity for the survival of NATO, because without it, NATO won't make it. And the best example about all this will be what took place in Libya. You recall how the events in Libya as part of the Arab Spring started first, but the level of violence, the level of violence was far beyond what NATO members have expected, especially in France, Germany, Britain, Portugal, Italy. They did not expect that level, and that will prompt NATO to interfere into the conflict and sort of resolve. Here's the interesting thing. Did you know that most of the sorties that NATO conducted back then had to be with the assistance of the United States? So for something like this, even NATO members in Europe, they couldn't deal with that. They needed the leadership of the United States. And at the same time, we can't be everywhere. Because when you look back now at the in Afghanistan, things are not settling yet. We still have issues there, security issues there. NATO cannot be there forever. And the cost associated with us being there on a long term.
It's like, to me, it's like a mafia organization. We're going to give you protection, but you're going to have to pay. You're going to have to pay. And if you don't pay, you're not protected.
Exactly. Well, just last year, Duke, there were only, I believe, two countries, the United States and, if I am not mistaken, it was not Slovenia. I think it was Estonia. Only the United States and Estonia increased the budget by 2%. Their share of the budget. Those are the only two countries that did that. So the question becomes, we can't just be the one carrying the financial burden and the logistics and what comes with all the military operations. We can't do it.
And on top of all that, there's no gratitude for what we do.
No.
You know, it's like if you could just be acknowledged, instead our president has to go around and apologize for all of our successes. Well, hey, it's because of our successes that we've been able to contribute so much. It's because the policies of this country, because of our Constitution, all the things that we are trying to preserve. Some people don't care about preserving them. And that's what scares me about NATO. You start talking about a police force that has more authority than, say, your local police, some sort of international police force. It seems as though we've totally turned over our sovereignty. And someone like me, I think, you know, if we can remove the hooks from us, that we might somehow regain some sovereignty.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the way to look at this, to put this in context, what you just said, in context, just look at the behavior of Russia right now in the Middle East. And that will give you an idea. Russia's thinking is, you know, I can challenge U.S. leadership in the Middle East. And you and I understand, fully understand, with the nuclear deal with Iran, Iran is going to become the platform for China and Russia to expand their sphere of influence in the Middle East and far beyond. And that's what we need the most.
They're going to load up on their nuclear materials, and they're going to do it all on the back of Iran. And they used Iran as a guinea pig, and it worked. America took the bait. Obama took the bait. And we're giving them everything they want. Russia and China are laughing all the way to the bank.
And that's what worries me the most. And I will not be surprised. And I mentioned that in my upcoming book. I will not be surprised when China and Russia enter into a military treaty with Iran. China could establish a naval base. Russia could establish an air force base on an Iranian territory. And what you have basically is an axis of three or four countries that's going to stand militarily and be ready to challenge the United States in the region. And once you challenge the U.S. in the Middle East, you're saying to the rest of the world, I can challenge you anywhere. Look what's taking place now in South China Sea. And what bothers me the most... Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Howell, go ahead.
I'm agreeing with you, Doctor, and it kind of like, if you think about what you just said, if you really go back, let's say, to the beginning of the Middle East, of the Ottoman Empire during World War One. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in World War One, I think it was basically the French and the British basically divided the Middle East.
And correct.
The thing is, and I wish the U.S. would have gotten involved, but the thing is, there was no oil. Oil wasn't discovered until the 1930s. If there would have been some geologist would have said, hey, there's oil here, I guarantee we would have been there and we would have divided it. But unfortunately, the French took Syria. They made it in. And now what you just said, it's like history repeating itself. But you said, you know, God forbid that China gets involved with Russia. And they go with Iran and says, hey, you know what? Let's divide it. Let's divide the Middle East, and we'll divide it this way. And everybody's happy, and the U.S. is out. That's basically what's going to happen.
Which that's what China and Russia is aiming at. Vladimir Putin doesn't act randomly. There is always something behind his policy. This is something that I remembered one presentation I did at Fordham before some generals there. And we were talking about geopolitics in the Middle East. And just to tie this one to you, there's about the oil aspects of it. It was the representative of China, Wu Suka, that was the representative to the Middle East in 2013. He stated the following, and I quote, maintaining peace and stability in the Middle East is also a common interest of both countries, meaning China and the U.S. There is a great deal both countries can achieve through cooperation, which will help bring about the balanced development of the world economy and global geopolitical stability. The interesting part about all this, Duke, is that the answer came from none other than Henry Kissinger, which was in October 16, 2013, same year. And his statement was the following, which was very interesting, and I quote, you could not make plans in the Middle East or involving Middle East crisis without keeping in mind the consideration of the oil market. But that is now changing substantially, narrowing the gap between supply and demand in North America, and is now a huge strategic consequence. So you can just see the... as you guys mentioned about the importance of oil there, and have changed the dynamics to why, for example, China will want to be in the Middle East. And to my surprise, after in 2008, after the invasion of Iraq, Chinese won some major oil contracts to the point that the Iraqi government under Maliki at the time told ExxonMobil, an American oil company, you guys are not going to get a contract. Chinese firm's going to get it. We're the one who paid for the war. We're the one who bled the grounds. And the Chinese, all they had to do was walk in and get a contract. And to me, those are the signs that tells you, okay, we don't have to worry about the U.S. anymore because the U.S. has no more credibility. It's almost like saying to the rest of the world, they can't do anything about it. They just talk. There is no action. They're just words. And countries pick up on this stuff. Pick up on
it. I totally agree with you there. We have relinquished any sort of credibility and but, you know, I think that was Obama's intention. I truly believe that he needed to lower our rank. He needed to reduce our stature. And, you know, he every time I think of Obama, I just think of getting hustled. I think of getting sold something that... total misrepresentation. You know, I thought I was buying a luxury car, and instead I've got a bicycle. You know, it's everything he says to me is misspeak. He, you know, sleight of hand, misdirection. I don't know. There's just no trust in government. That's why no one wants these Syrian refugees coming in, because, you know, as you said in the previous show, We can't screen them. Well, we've got Joel on the line with this. Maybe, I mean, I don't know. What are you doing now for the immigration agency?
I guess it's one of those topics that a lot of these candidates have in their platforms. A lot of people that really don't understand what's going on, and this is going to be a surprise to a lot of people, but we've been taking refugees the past 5 years, you know. So don't be surprised that they're saying, oh, you know, the Syrians are coming. Well, they've been here since the past 5 years. They've been coming in. And, you know, the thing is, we have a very good system. You know, we you know, do a lot of work, especially to bring a certain person in. And so out of a million... are you going to have one person that will somehow mislead, misinform? Yes. I mean, that it's going to be possible, because the people that are actually doing this type of work, we're human beings. We're not, you know, superhumans that we can detect every single person. But out of 1 million people, you'll probably have maybe one or two that could probably get in. I mean, that can happen, and we go through a thorough type of investigations, backgrounds, and to get the actual person that's there, you know, that stating their story, how they're being persecuted by their government. If they stay in their country, they're going to be brutally mistreated, actually murdered, or actually killed because they don't support the beliefs of their previous government or the government that exists right now in their country, and that's why they're fleeing. And that's why also you had a lot of people during that time, also within those past years, you had a lot of people in Asia, when we're talking like Nepal, a lot of people that came from Africa, and so they're coming. And the thing is, you know, you might have a lot of governors saying that, no, we're not going to, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I'm sorry. It is going to happen. You know,
yeah, it's
just,
a federal law. It's a federal law.
Yes. And they're going to come in.
Well, go ahead, finish that.
Oh yeah. And they're going to come and they're going to be here and, you know, we're going to have to, you know, do our best. You know, you know, to accommodate them, and that's when our taxpayer dollars come into hand, and you know, and you know, taking care of these.
I've heard that there's no way to truly vet them. There's no way to tell, you know, Dr. Wallaloo, how many of them are going to say that they're all being persecuted? Aren't they all going to say they're being persecuted?
It would be a large number. Well, as I mentioned last time, you're going to have officers that's going to conduct the vetting. They have to be well-versed into the culture and linguistically capable, intellectually skilled, of course, and because you're going to be dealing with a different level of segments within the society. And in those countries, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, Turkey, you name it, those are tribal societies. The loyalty lies with the tribe. So it's not an easy undertaking. And as I said last time, when you send somebody who is not well-versed into the culture to interview one of the refugees, whatever, individuals in charge in the United States need to reconsider that option and figure out a better way of sending officers who are either born here, native, or whatever you want to call it, that they have a thorough understanding of the culture. Because it has to do with the nature of the questions you're going to be asking to vet this individual.
What percentage, Joel, of people that you talk to are technically applying for refugee status?
I'm going to say right now, I'm going to say about 20%. I mean, that's right now. Can the number grow? Yes. And I guess I'll share this with you today. You know, I was handling a certain person, you know, from the Middle East, and as we were talking, of course, I have a couple of I can speak a little bit of Arabic, and it made him feel comfortable at the same time, and once he asked me, have you been to this place? And I go, yes. And we were talking about Morocco, and all of a sudden he goes, did you feel safe there? And I go, well, yes and no, depending, you know, at the time, because I was trying to buy something and negotiating, especially in the market there, sometimes they can get a little bit hostile. And so he started laughing, but then he goes, well, I don't feel safe. And I tell you this because I'm Moroccan. And then he kind of told me the difference between the South and the North, how the North discriminates the South, and because they're a little bit, they're different, and the North's a little, they're more like Anglo-whites, and they have more money. And then so he was telling me, now that he lives here in Dallas, he goes, did you know that you would think that just because we fled Morocco and we're here in Dallas, that we'd actually be united? We're actually divided. And now they're dividing into three, because now, before there was two of us, now there's three of us. Like, well, how's that? Because the ones that were rich, and now they're a little bit richer, so now they decided themselves to declassify from the North and the South, and they're making their own section. I started laughing. I go, well, so where do you fall in? He goes, well, I'm in the South side. And I started laughing, because he says the same mentality that's there is brought over here, thinking that they would unite. You know what? Hey, I guess the country was wrong. We're over here in this new country. Let's adapt to the way the culture is here. No, they brought their own culture. At the same time, there's Moroccans. If they're from the North and the South, they will not mix here, because he actually told me they're divided. And so, I mean, that kind of surprised me at the same time when he told me that, and he was being very sincere.
And Dr. Wallaloo, you're from Morocco, aren't you?
I was indeed born in Morocco. Indeed, yeah.
And doc, I don't know if that's correct or not, because that's basically what he told me, and I was.
It is correct. The north and the south, two, because when you go to the north, not only the white and blue eyes and whatever, they also speak Spanish in the north. In the south, in the south they are more traditionalist. They are more conservative and so forth. And there's that division between. I was born in Sali City, which is near the capital, so I was in between. And my family are European, so I acquired the culture, but I acquired also certain values at home that are more European and so forth. Just you brought up one interesting point about them moving over here, and that's the issue with immigration. Immigrants, when they move to the United States, they are not thinking of assimilating into the culture. They think in terms of, I'm going to move to the U.S., but I'm going to live with my own culture. It doesn't work that way. When you move to the United States, you're going to have to learn about the United States culture. You're going to have to learn about the Constitution. You're going to have to learn about the Bill of Rights. You're going to have to adapt. That's what it means to become an American. Yes, I understand you have your identity and so forth. You have your religion, whatever. But here in the United States, there is only one document we have called the Constitution. We live according to the laws of the land. And if you are not able to assimilate, then maybe you have to reconsider, pack your bag, and head it back. Because that's our problem here. That's why you start to see these divisions. People want to move here, but they don't want to live the way we live here. Well, if you don't want to live the way we live here, then you need to go back. Obviously, you are not incapable of handling the socio-economic changes that have impacted your life. And that's one issue I have noticed when I talk to immigrants. They're struggling with that concept. They're struggling with, okay, who do I identify with? Well, you are an American if that is what you want. And if you want to be an American, you're going to have to learn. You're going to have to acquire the knowledge about the country, its language, its culture, its values, and so forth.
I see it kind of like it's a mental hang up that they have.
Exactly.
Number one, they had to come to this country. So in a way, I think mentally they feel like they're starting on their knees, and they're not going to bow to this country, even though this country is essentially saving their lives and the lives of their families. But they're not going to humble themselves and take on our way of living. Instead, they're going to maintain their pride in their home country, and try to hold it as long as they possibly can. I don't get that either. To me, this country is falling apart because there's no loyalty for the country anymore. People aren't willing to sacrifice like they used to.
And second thing, Dick, is we're allowing just whoever. And I'm going to have to say it. We are not, when you look at the level of intellectual of individuals coming over, we're not getting the best. And you cannot survive or develop or move forward with a mediocre mind. You just can't. It doesn't work. And I'll say it straightforward. If we're going to keep doing business the way we're doing it now, in 50 years, it's going to be a different picture altogether.
Well, and you know, the thing is, that the people that are listening, a lot of them vote. We have a lot of new listeners who are a potential first-time voters or just sporadic voters.
Mm-hmm.
Voting matters. Voting for a certain candidate in a certain primary matters. And Joel, interesting how I got to know him. He was running for state house of representatives in the Republican Party, but he used to be a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And so he switched parties. And when I went down to South Texas to meet him and interview him and Miriam Martinez, basically I was intrigued at the I'll call it the awakening that took place. Howell, could you share a little bit of that story with the listeners?
Yes. When I first ran back in 2010, I ran as a Democrat, and at that time, you know, growing up in my family, we were Democrats. But you have to realize that back when I was growing up, you know, even though you were considered a Democrat, I had Christian values. We were very conservative, and so that's where I felt. So when I ran the first time, and I saw behind the scenes the way the actual party was and the way it was moving, I knew I did the biggest mistake of my life, you know, and so it went well. But then once I realized that what, you know, my values, everything that was, you know, that I wanted to do and was not for that party. So, you know, in 2012, I made a decision to run again, and I ran under the Republican Party with my ideas, with my conservative ideas, and I ran with that platform. And the thing is, in South Texas, what it is, it's the same culture and the same mentality. And the thing is, it's just an awakening, and people don't realize. A lot of people, if you actually interview people down there and just ask them certain questions, I guarantee you those questions that you ask them, they're going to correctly. And then you're going to tell them, well, by answering these questions, you know, you're a Republican, because these are the questions that are a Republican actually, you know, ask any Republican, and you just answered it correctly. And so you're considered a Republican, and that would like shock people. And that's basically what I started doing. I started talking to people when I would go and knock on their doors. I would just ask them certain questions, and they can answer those questions. Sure enough, these people would answer them correctly, and I would, you're a Republican, believe it or not, because you believe in this, and you believe in these questions. And that's how I got. I was trying to get my word across, but you know, unfortunately, you know, we fought, but you know, we came up short. But at the same time,
that's a tough battle.
That's
a tough battle down there. But hey, at least you switched. I used to vote for a Democrat presidents when I was young and didn't know any better. Now I you know, hey, I can't change the past. It was what it was. But now I understand the difference in the party. Dr. Wallaloo, you teach college students. You talk politics. You talk about all these things. The party structure, I mean, there's so much division. Do you think there's any way, do you think there's some sort of light at the end of the tunnel that the parties can work together to save the country?
Well, eventually that's going to have to happen for the sake of the country. I mean, if the party is going to be thinking only about what's good for them, then they will be they will take part in putting our country down the drain. I mean, at some point, they're going to have to. What concerns me the most now is, for example, and I'm not picking on anybody, and you know that, Dick, I'm not this or that. The candidates, certain candidates that the Republican Party are presenting, they just don't make any sense. They don't represent the true Republican Party that at least I learned about. And that, to me, it's an alarming. You cannot sort of just promote whoever. You're going to have to reflect your views and your values and how you're going to be perceived in the rest of the country. And what party is doing that? And when I ask my students about this kind of questions, they said, well, Dr. O, we're just so confused in the sense that they are representing this party, but they are not representing the values of that party. And I kind of understand what they're talking about in a sense. Yes, you get an individual who's saying, oh, yes, I am a Republican, but the values that Republican holds are completely different from what that particular candidate's saying. that creates confusion. Nonetheless, what I noticed, at least in the last 2 years or so, when I talk to my students about voting and so forth, they are eager to be part of the process. They want to be part of the political process.
Mm-hmm.
Yet some of them think in terms of, well, my vote doesn't matter. And in my answer right away, I said, no, it does matter. It does matter. The journey of 1,000 miles starts with the first step. Because if you keep that attitude of, well, my vote doesn't matter, so I won't bother, then the next person is going to do the same. The next person is going to do the same. Then what are we going to end up with? We, you, me, he, she, all of us are the backbone of this democracy. Because democracy is not just words. It's deed and action. And this is where the big issue is. Yeah. This is where the big issue is.
Well, I'll tell you what, the program is coming to an end. I'm going to give each of you a final opportunity to make a statement, and I'll start with Joel, just a minute or so on a final statement from you.
You know, 2016 is coming around, and like the doctor said, you know, candidates are going to have different platforms, but it's going to be up to the individual. And just the way he was brought up with his values, the way he's thinking. I mean, just basically go out there, and if you're going to vote, but make sure you investigate every single candidate and make sure that whatever he's – that their platform is equivalent to your values, and that's the candidate for you, then so on, go out there and vote for that person.
Awesome, great point. And Dr. Walaloo?
Well, I fear U.S. foreign policy has become dependent on politicians who prefer short-term gains over long-term strategies. They prefer confrontation instead of diplomacy, and they are easy to recognize. They care more about their political careers, status, and power than doing the right thing for the country, and dragging it into unnecessary military confrontations will not be the right thing to do. And I just close in by what Thomas Jefferson once said, and he was right. He said, and I quote, "I abhor war and view it as the greatest scourge of mankind." And yet, how many impatient some of us seems to be, yet more for it.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you both for calling in. Dr. Walaloo, always good to have you on every Thursday night. Very insightful, very knowledgeable and in-depth information. You're not going to find this on your standard talking point radio show. And, you know, my goal is to communicate the information so that we can educate people and help people to make better decisions about politics, about policy, about the future of this country. I hope that you go to my Facebook page and like it, The Duke Machado Show. Find me on Twitter, at Duke Machado, and I guess you follow me on Twitter. We're here. We're doing this every Monday through Thursday night, 10 p.m. Central Standard Time, The Duke Machado Show. I'm out of here. Thank you again, guys. Appreciate you calling in.
All right. Thank you, Duke.